Capitalism doesn't make sense if there's no scarcity.
I'll take an authoritarian regime that ensures I can get my next meal.
All modern medicine is built on a pile of bones.
The Constitution is not there to answer problems about a crisis. Philosophers.
Philosophers.
So, David, what are we talking about today?
We're going to talk about crises.
Crises.
Yes. No, maybe not any particular crisis. We might talk about different types of them, I guess, if it becomes important. But more importantly, the role of authority, a government, during a crisis, and whether it is better or worse to have one in such a time.
Well, I would argue that it is always worse to have a crisis. So
to have a crisis?
Yeah.
Well, yes, it is always worse to have a crisis.
No, it's always worse to have crises than crisis.
It's also worse to have a Chrysler.
Christ. yeah. So yeah, crises. I think the original thing that we had talked about with this episode is, you know, we don't try to be too topical here on Philosophers, but I don't think it's topical anymore, but there was a time in which there was a more or less global crisis, depending on your perspective. And there was a lot of things that happened during that crisis. Like, a lot of governments did things. And I think that there are people that would be willing to make arguments both ways, that the government, insert your government here, dear listeners outside of the United States, did good for the crisis or did bad for the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And what's funny about that is that it has been years after the fact now, and we still can't seem to agree. When I say we, I mean like people, there is not a clear-cut consensus as to whether or not it was good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, let's talk about crisis. I think the first thing that goes without saying is there's always this underlying assumption. I would assume that most people think that it is better to have strong authorities in a crisis.
Well, yes, this is evidenced by there's interesting and disturbing statistics about public opinion of, like, authoritarian government during a crisis.
Yep.
Particularly certain types of crises, but generally speaking, yeah, whenever there is a crisis facing society, people are much more accepting of just giving power to the government.
Yep. And if you look at a lot of authoritarian regimes that have occurred throughout history,
they take power during a crisis.
Yep. And most importantly, it's like one of the easiest ways for like republics and democracies, non-authoritarian government, they're all authoritarian, changed my mind, but like non-dictatorships, you know, monarchies, you know, governments that have delegated and representative forms of authority often give way to a strong man during a crisis. Mm-hmm. I mean, Rome did it multiple times. Athens did it.
Well, Rome had a system for it.
Yeah. They just acknowledged it. Like, and honestly, I give Rome props for that. Like, say what you will about the Roman system of government, I feel like there was not very much by way of charades in the Roman government, at least in that way it was set up. Don't get me wrong, there was still plenty of political gamesmanship going on, but the system was set out just acknowledging that, look, people are going to feel like it is necessary to do this, so we're just going to put in a way to do it.
Rather than letting like a senator pretend to be a king and then possibly seizing power unjustly that way and holding on to it, we're just going to have this release valve where if things get bad enough, we can just appoint a dictator and it can be anybody.
Yeah. And I think arguably by creating the avenue towards a dictatorship, it drew attention to the fact that this was a possibility and that you actually needed to get the votes to do it. And it implies that the consequences, the fact that you even had to vote to get there, and it was known that you had to vote to get there, it was obvious, it wasn't something that was created out of thin air during the crisis, help people acknowledge that, you know, there's a reason why we have to vote for this. There's a reason why we aren't expected to come up with a solution on the spot. This should be treated with caution. And even like the most, one, arguably one of the more famous dictators of Rome, Julius Caesar, had to like tiptoe around the idea of becoming a king, and like test the waters in a way that you wouldn't have to in a system, I think, where the pathway wasn't obvious. It was just something you could do. And you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. I think that's actually kind of neat how that worked. It's kind of counterintuitive as well, because you would think that if you wanted a non-authoritarian form of government, you would want to create no pathways to end up having one. But I feel like that also just kind of creates this fog of war where, like, anybody who's thinking knows that option's actually there.
Because it always is. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's harmful to pretend like it's not.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I give the Romans credit for that. And treating it with the respect it deserved. But, and in the same vein, you know, even in the modern day, there's a saying, you know, any good politician will not let a good crisis go to waste.
Right.
You know? And I think that, at least in the conspiracy theorist realm, which, see our episode about conspiracy theorists, if you want to know our true feelings about that. But this is one of those where it's not that crazy, I think, to think that there are such a thing as manufactured crises.
Mm-hmm.
And they would not exist if it was not a viable method by which you could seize power.
Right. It is so easy to seize power during a crisis that, it is a very easy logical jump to think that, okay, yeah, the people in power are creating these crises so that they can seize more power.
Right. And arguably it has happened a couple of times.
Sure.
You know, blame the man on Spain, you know,
or whatever. Right. Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. We know for a fact that the United States has manufactured crises as an excuse to go to war.
Yeah. So there you go.
So there we go.
But about that. So I think the other thing we kind of maybe wanted to talk about with this, which these may interplay as topics, I'm just going to go ahead and acknowledge it, is that here at Philosophers, we advocate for principles, you know, have them.
Yes.
Mainly. We may disagree with them, but the thing that I think we will almost always universally disagree with is not having any. But crises are unique situations, and I feel like those are the times in which your principles are the most tested.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard people make arguments in that vein. So to set the context for this one, there is a popular video game, which is now being made into a television series, that's drawing some interesting comments. Because one of the survivors, it was The Last of Us, one of the characters as a survivor makes it to this commune, and he's talking to two people that are working in this commune, and one of them is explaining what they're doing and how it's a great place to live because they work together, and the other one says, yeah, we're communists, and the other one says, well, you know, we're not communists, and they're arguing over political definitions in a crisis. And I've heard arguments to the vein of, see, the reason people revert to communist behavior is because it is the most resilient form of government in a crisis, and that's why we should just do it all the time, right? And then other people make the argument that I think is correct, which is that there is a big difference between operating within normalcy and operating within a crisis and survival. But that brings up an interesting question as to whether or not your principles would hold in that crisis, and should you be allowed to change them for a crisis?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing that I think of when we raise the idea of changing principles based on the circumstances is, okay, we're going all the way back to, why do we have principles in the first place? What are they supposed to do for us? I think that the reason that we come up with all these systems is to give us a way to operate in our circumstances. Well, if those circumstances change, then you need to change the rules. the classic one that I go to when looking toward the future is post-scarcity society.
Mm-hmm.
Capitalism doesn't make any sense if there's no scarcity. The whole reason for capitalism is because we're dealing with scarce resources.
Yeah. It's not just because it's capitalism. Economics doesn't make sense in post-scarcity, really.
Right, we're not trading anymore. Like, that's just not if there's no scarcity, we don't think about who gets what resources. Right. Everyone gets whatever resources. We don't think about that.
Right. And, I mean, I guess you could play word games with it to some degree to say, like here's another example. Like, I, as a general principle, some people might hold as a principle that they do not harm people other they would not harm other people.
Right, a pacifist.
They're a pacifist. Well, let's go to everyone's favorite political testing ground, the desert island with two people. Mm-hmm. At what point do you actually kill someone for a coconut, you know? And how does that square your logic? And I think the reason that that's used as an analogy, even though it is ludicrous in the extreme, is because it does bring up a good point, which is like how do I think it's better for testing whether or not your principles change.
Or the other classic example that always gets brought up, it is against my principles to steal anything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but what if you're starving and there's food that you could steal?
Right.
Yeah, you're going to steal the food. Like,
yeah, which is
if
why
you're honest with yourself, you will admit that you will steal the food.
Yeah. Yeah. No one is
that dedicated to not stealing.
Yeah. Only a liar would not steal if they're starving. But that's why, you know, I think, you know, back when we talked about principles and we can't have a conversation without bringing up pragmatism. It's kind of why pragmatism is a really good, like looking at things from a pragmatic point of view is a really good way to construct principles, is because you can actually build them into your principles from the get-go. You know, back.
Right. What is your goal? What do you want?
Yeah.
That's the first thing you start with. Everything else depends on what you're actually trying to do.
Mm-hmm. And then if you can prioritize those things, it makes it very simple and easy, you know, and that's why it's easy enough to just say things like, oh, don't steal, don't kill, whatever. But the reality is that, you know, there are circumstances, like most people who say, yeah, it's wrong to kill people, except when self-defense. Most people would agree that the self-defense is an okay time to kill someone else to prevent dying yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Does that apply when it comes to starvation? Why not? You know, but maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But if you rank survival as the primary principle, you know, it's like, step one, stay alive. Okay.
Right.
As long
then as I'm just admitting to myself that if it's me or you, it's me. If I can make it that way. Like,
right. And I think some people who, again, are liars would think to themselves, well, I don't know that I would put myself above others. Okay. Well, tell me, you know, I would love to know what it's like to live with no problems because people take care of you. But in reality, you probably would, you know. It's a good saying that, you know, I forget exactly how it goes, but something to the tune of any civilized society is only 3 missed meals away from pure and total anarchy, mm-hmm. which is totally true. Like, there's countless examples of that having happened, you know. And that might also be a reason why we feel like strong men are needed in the event of a crisis, because if all bets are off, I'll take an authoritarian regime that ensures I can get my next meal, even if it's forcing me into backbreaking labor, over running the risk of having to fight for that food myself.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And on the one hand, I can't really blame people, because if I was faced with that option, like if the Gestapo was at my door and said, you know, you're going to go work in the labor camps in exchange for 3 squares a day, or we're going to kick you to the curb into the wildlands where you're going to have to, or we're going to throw you into a pen with a bunch of other people where you're going to fight over scraps of food yourself, I'd probably, you know, get my overalls on and go work in the labor camp, because one's a guaranteed way to eat, and without eating, I'll die. So I might deal with the whole Gestapo problem later, but mm-hmm. right now food is more important. You know what I mean?
Right. Today I have to eat.
Today I have to eat. Tomorrow I will seek freedom. You know? So I do understand that to some degree, but how do you deal with that? Or is it just like something is how it is? Or is there ways you can mitigate that? I don't know. Like, I think there are definitely ways you can, obviously avoiding a crisis is probably the best strategy.
Well, yes. The best way to survive a crisis is not get in one. Yeah.
Yeah.
But easier said than done sometimes.
Definitely. And also, I mean, not to go too deep into this conversation, but like, I would always argue for some semblance of self-reliance, right? I think in general, one of the best ways to secure your fate in a crisis is to prepare to do so, you know? Yeah,
that's good. I think I think a lot of crises that affect, crises that are relevant to the question of, you know, propping up an authority during them, are often created by authority in the first place.
True.
And not, as we mentioned earlier, in the sense of manufactured crises, but like authority maybe even in good faith, doing its best to try to solve some problem, ends up creating a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most market tampering does this. You know, it... We need to have an economist guest on our show at some point.
We do.
But to do my best. The reason that people speak so highly of the free market is that it seems to just magically solve problems when you run through the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes people don't like the mechanisms by which it solves these problems.
Sure.
And they want to try to take shortcuts by fiddling with things. But now you've disrupted the system. It's not a free market anymore. So the rules are broken.
Yeah. I think an excellent example of that is like the Gilded Age in the United States. Coal mines and harsh industrial environments were not just created by business magnates wanting to be cruel. The demand for those post-industrial society goods created a demand for those working conditions. Mix that with a lack of jobs creates a low price to be paid for those things.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it takes to have those things. You know, I think the modern analogy for that is people advocating for higher wages, which on paper seems like a great idea. It's like, yeah, I would love for people. I think everybody should deserve the money, a livable wage. No, you don't actually, because you're not prepared to pay $93 for a salad. Because when you actually look at what it would cost for backbreaking labor to harvest the goods to make that salad, if every single person involved along the way made that minimum wage, that salad would cost $93. And it's almost counterintuitive because that means that people would not be able to afford it, and it would drive down demand. It would drive down demand for that good to the point where those people are now just unemployed. And this is something you see happen a lot, that when minimum wages go up, employability goes down. And so you kind of end up causing the exact same problem before.
Yeah, you raise the barrier to employment. Now you have to justify that you're worth this higher wage.
Right. And so it's actually, and what's kind of deceptive, I feel like, about that is you can look at it from the perspective of, did the wages go up, and pat yourself on the back when they did. But if you also take into account unemployment and you average unemployment people in as $0 an hour wage people, it's usually harmful.
Right.
Or in the cases where it isn't, it's because people are circumnavigating that law you created in the first place by working part-time, where you don't...
Part-time or under the table.
Exactly. And that's, I think, the true thing about, you know, the free market that's amazing, is that it always wants to be free.
Yes.
It doesn't want to be corralled, and by the nature of people deliberately going into black and gray markets, which I think... This is a thing I wanted to address. I was talking to someone about black and gray markets a while back, and they kind of laughed and thought that I was being kind of ridiculous, because in their head, a black market was like a shady warehouse where you went to buy things. Like, they had like a cartoonish representation. They're like, oh yeah, let's just pop up a black market. Yeah, we'll just go buy a warehouse. And, you know, it's like,
right, and sell drugs and body parts and whatever.
Exactly. And
like,
I was like,
no.
Yeah, I was like, no, like, black markets exist everywhere. Like, honestly, and you mentioned one of them, drugs are still just a massive black market, but it's not taking place in warehouses and stuff like that. It's being facilitated by people driving
all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah. A black market can be the bedroom, a living room in an apartment where a guy just happens to have 2 pounds of weed in a top shelf and is dealing it out by the gram to clients.
Right. Anytime people are doing commerce illegally is the black market.
Yeah. Every time you pay some high school student or college student to come cut your grass and you pay them $50 in cash, they're not...
And they don't pay taxes on it. Yeah.
Yeah. They're not running down to their local accountant's office to pay their taxes on that income, you know?
Right.
Lemonade stands, like, the, you know, arguably the black market is... just as large, if not larger. Like, every yard sale is a black market.
Right.
Really. Like, it's all around you and it's everywhere. And people do these things because it's just way more efficient and you actually get the value for what you need. You know, So yeah.
Well, yeah, because I'm not opening up a business and setting up all my taxes and stuff like that just to get rid of some junk that I need rid of or whatever.
Sure. Yeah. So, and those things would occur in any time, especially during a crisis. I would argue that you see more black markets during a crisis than any other time. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but you can bet that the Soviet Union was rife with black and gray markets during its time.
Sure.
You know, even and deliberately to fight the policies of the state, even though the state was arguing for things that, you know, on paper make a lot of sense. Like, yes, the government is going to guarantee you free bread, but that doesn't mean the government can write into law that bread will be manifested into the environment. You know what I mean?
Right. It's just ink on paper.
Yeah. I would even argue things like traveling for healthcare, like healthcare tourism, are things like black markets. And
kinda.
I mean, it's black markets in the way that you're circumventing like what was meant to be going on and taking place. And they often happen in ways that, you know, you wouldn't think. Because I think most people, when they think about like healthcare tourism, I don't know about you, but the first thing that jumps to mind for a lot of people is like, yeah, people in places like the United States traveling to countries that have free, air quotes, healthcare to get treatment. But there are way more people traveling to countries that have good healthcare that, and they're paying for that service, than people going to another country where they can get a worse quality service for a lower price, you know, or they're going to a less regulated market.
Yeah, I was going to say that, yeah, usually what I think of, yeah, is going to another country to get cheap drugs.
Yeah.
For their condition, which are the prices inflated here in the United States because of regulations.
Yeah. Or you're going to, like, Mexico to get surgery because there are not huge controls on how many doctors there can be, and they have to get all of these different, you know, certifications and regulations to make sure you can even practice in the first place, which again, you know, to be fair, higher risks in one way, but that's what you get with the free market as well. Like you said before, people may not be happy, you know, like imagine if there was no requirements to be a doctor. You could just open up a doctor's office, which by the way, vast majority of human history,
exactly how that worked. Yeah,
is exactly how it worked. And that's why your doctor, your dentist, your construction worker may have been the same person. Are you good with tools? Cool.
I have steady hands.
You're a doctor now. like what was it? I think like the quartermaster of a ship back in the day, if they did not have a doctor, was the doctor. Terrifying to think about, but true. I think a lot of people would imagine that all of a sudden we would devolve into some like archaic form where people were just getting limbs hacked off left and right. But I mean, that's what was happening in medical institutions at the time anyway.
Right. That was just medicine.
Yeah. That's just how it was. Oh, you got a splinter and it's gone gangrene. Well,
don't know what to do about that, but we can cut it off.
We can cut it off. Yep. You might die in the process, but you probably would anyway. And the people performing these surgeries, you know, if you were a licensed physician back then, all that meant was is that you just killed more people because you had more opportunities to perform the surgeries in the first place. So you got good at not killing people by killing some people along the way.
Right.
On accident.
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously we want to minimize that.
All modern medicine is built on a pile of bones.
yeah. A lot of dead people to get good at medicine. So I don't know. Back to the whole crisis thing, though. Like, we've kind of addressed the biggest elephant with crisis, which is that it's a vessel for authoritarianism. So how do you, well, we talked about it. Like, how do you prevent that? Or should we be preventing it? Or is it just a necessary function? What if, you know, there are other scenarios, which is like whether or not you should play along with that happening, or do you not? Like, I feel like a lot of it's just open to the circumstance of like what the, like, or the nature of the crisis itself, you know?
Yeah. I think, ideally we have something like the Roman system where there's just there, this is an automatic release valve that we have, and there's a time limit built into it, because the way this happens in America now is we do this. We give emergency provisions to the executive.
martial law and executive orders exist for this reason.
Right. Well, executive orders do have a time limit.
They do.
But some other emergency things don't, or they just keep getting like renewed forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And these are the ones done by Congress, though.
Yeah.
Which are worse.
That's true.
FISA courts,
mm-hmm.
for example.
Yeah.
What are those, David?
Well, they're not courts.
Depends on who you ask.
I don't remember all the details right now, but I mean, like, it's basically terrorism court, mm-hmm. essentially.
And it's more like a court-martial than anything.
Yes, it's terrorism court-martial behind closed doors.
Where we swear we're upholding the public good, I swear.
Right, honest, yeah.
I swear honest, yeah. Also, if you are indicted in one of these courts and you talk about what's going on, that's also a crime.
Right, that's part of the whole closed doors thing. Yeah. No whistleblowing.
Yeah.
You shouldn't need to, though. It's a court.
Right, and you would only be blowing the whistle on yourself anyway, so you wouldn't want to do that anyway.
Right.
So we're helping you not hurt your case.
Citizen.
Yeah. But, you know, it's fine. We'll just keep going with it. Yeah, I think that's one thing, is making it a priority to undo the shackles caused. Because I feel like nowadays it is less common, or what you see happening is not an instant power grab where someone asserts as dictator. That does happen, don't get me wrong. You know, good example, I think, and not to be too topical, but just to use as an example, perhaps. At the time of recording, there's currently a conflict or a war going on between the country of Ukraine and the Russian Federation. The current president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, how long has he been president for?
I don't remember. Not long.
Not long. When's his term up?
I don't know.
I would not be that surprised to hear that a war is not a good time to hold an election.
Right.
Just saying. You know, so that's an example of how it could happen. But in a country like the United States or Great Britain or other countries in the West where the democracies have existed on and the crises are not like that dire, it is more often like, you know, 9/11, I think, was like the poster child for government expansion and overreach.
Mm-hmm.
And it had broad support from the public. Because the public felt unsafe.
Right.
You know, most people do not remember that it was not that long ago that there was no such thing as security checkpoints at the airport.
Right.
That it is wild to tell people that now, but I remember, I was very young, but I remember just walking into the airport and just getting on the plane.
Like, right, what's the big deal?
Yeah, you just grab your ticket. It was like, okay, if you want to have the experience, go to a bus terminal.
Yeah, that's the same thing.
That's literally how getting on a plane was. Or train terminal, maybe. I think train terminals even have turnstiles now.
Yeah.
Which weren't a thing. Yeah, I guess maybe a bus station is a good, better analogy. But like, you walk in, go to the front desk, you buy your ticket. They tell you, yep, up the stairs to the left, down the causeway to your gate. And you just walked on down to your gate. If you checked a bag, you checked it downstairs. Or you just walked over down there, sat down, they checked your ticket, and you just jump on the plane and you go where you need to go. And that's how it was for all of aviation's history up until... Yeah,
that's how it was for flying until 9/11.
Yeah. And now, God forbid you have a toothpick longer than 3 inches.
Right.
You know what I mean? Or fluid and...
Yeah, I was going to say, or a shampoo bottle. Yeah.
Of more than 3 ounces. Yeah. Yeah, it's... And I hear probably some people saying, you know, well, that's because it was always a security vulnerability and it wasn't until someone exploited it that we needed to create the rule. So, but now we're all safer for it. Okay.
Maybe.
Are you
flying also sucks now.
Flying also sucks now.
I'm probably never going to fly commercially again.
Flying also way more expensive now because of that.
That's true. Yeah, because of all the stuff you have to jump through. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing, too. I think people don't understand the cost of these things that they're paying for, you know, or in a lot of cases, forcing everyone else to also pay for.
Right. Anything that's funded by taxes. Mm. Now, even though I don't fly, I'm paying for it.
Yes. I'm paying for you to be safe on the planes that I would never get on anyway.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Not really.
Not really. You know, screw you, actually.
You're not welcome, actually.
You are not actually welcome. you know, the NSA and spying on citizens nonstop. Most people don't realize that the National Security Administration is the youngest department of the executive branch, and it's really new. It has the Department of Homeland Security,
under which
the NSA is. But yeah, the Department of Homeland Security did not come about until after 9/11, 2001. Mm-hmm. Most people don't know that. And they maybe don't even realize that it is just as big and has just as much oversight and authority as things like the Department of Defense, which used to just be by its more honest name, the War Department.
Yes.
Which is what it was called when it was originally created. It was rebranded later to, you know, obfuscate the, you know, fact that, you know, we shouldn't have a department all about going to war. So let's create one that's all about going to war and then name it defense, because that's more...
That sounds better.
Sounds better, yeah. A lot of defense spending goes on in very offensive wars elsewhere, but, you know, that's great.
Yeah, we're defending ourselves over there.
Yeah.
On the other side of the planet.
Yeah, preemptive orbital bombardment.
Hey, you never know.
You never know, right? So, yeah, I mean, cutting back on those things in peacetime would be great. But it's... But the follow-on to that is it seems so much more difficult to unpass a law than it does to pass one. You know, and maybe that's a part of the problem, is that it is way harder to undo something than it is to just do it in the first place. I think you and I have talked about this on the show before, but, like, I think this is just another notch in the belt of the reason as to why it would be good for laws to just have expiration dates as well. Because... you know, laws can get passed in a public panic for broader appeal and voter support.
It's so hard to take them off the books, though.
Yeah. And underlying, there's a deeper cultural issue of most people do not want to elect somebody to do nothing or to undo things. They want to elect people to do things. But, you know,
which is why the United States Code is incomprehensibly large
and conflicting all the time.
Right.
And we have to have courts that are interpreting laws that conflict to balance it all out. That's, by the way, getting harder and harder as more and more laws get stacked on top of each other.
Yes.
But none of them ever get removed or amended, you know? And I think this is kind of why constitutions are a good thing. You know, there are a lot of things in the Constitution that some people would argue did not age well and don't make sense anymore. Right.
Yes.
The two biggest ones are the two that are the first two, actually, speech and arms, you know, mm-hmm. in the United States, at least. Those rights have just been endlessly eroded since they were created.
Right.
And to the point now where people argue whether or not they should exist. But I think the point is that they were put in there knowing that they were going to get abused, but knowing that they were also way more likely to just get restricted and regulated.
Right. If those amendments weren't there, then it wouldn't be long before they were just
outright not
allowed. Yeah, just not acknowledged at all. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, it is better to come up with something like a constitution that is supposed to be very nearly impossible to change, because the constitution is not there to answer problems about a crisis, but it is there to rein you back when you do something that's wrong, or to rein you back when you do overact in a crisis. And it's meant to counteract the actions of a skittish public and a populace. You know, I think there's a good saying that goes with this, that is, a person is smart, but people are stupid. You know, if you light a fire in a room with two people, the fire is probably going to get put out. But if you light a fire in a room with 100 people, people are going to die being trampled to death just trying to get out, you know? So you kind of want to write the laws while everyone's calm and thinking straight, because
mm-hmm.
we don't want fear to be used as a vehicle and a vessel to turn around and enslave people.
Right.
You know? So I think those are kind of recommendations that I would think about as ways to address these problems, but that, and also the one we mentioned before, just acknowledging that there are going to be crises and we need to create ways to deal with it and built-in pathways to reel that back in afterwards. Now, getting people who or would be in the hot seat to take that power to limit themselves is asking a lot, you know?
And yeah, that's the hard part.
That is the hard part. And it is, I mean, and it's only under very specific circumstances, it would seem, that these groups of people who don't have that incentive are in power to make that decision, you know? In Rome, it was the tyranny of Sulla. You know, for those of you who don't know your Roman history, and I'm not exactly an expert myself, there's a good Historia Civilis video about it, shout him out. But Rome had a tyrannical monarch by the name of Sulla that actually did just like have people executed or would list people as essentially not protected by the state who would were free game for the masses and caused a lot of unrest and tyranny. And only when that power was wrestled away in a civil war were those people of the mind where it's like, I just don't want that again. Like people were so afraid of that tyranny that they put laws in place. United States of America, same situation. They had just got done fighting a war with a very tyrannical monarch. And so those people were primed in a position to say, even though we have this power now, we are directly the victims of that abuse of that power. So we're going to put the holes in place, you know, and there hasn't been someone abusing that power in a way enough to scare enough people who would be replacing them to have that happen again. And I think we would all love to avoid that crisis if possible, you know. But when it comes to like personal politics, you know, I do think, you know, this episode topic goes beyond just systems of government. You know, what happens in the situation, like I mentioned earlier, you know, what about your politics in a crisis, you know, like in wartime, you know, imagine you live in a country that is war torn and you're with a bunch of survivors trying to deal, you know, or there has been like a catastrophic event, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. But like, all the normal systems of authority have broken down and people mm-hmm. are kind of, you know, you go to anarchy. However you arrive there, anarchy happens, right? How do that, that is like the most generic crisis there is just, you know, the head of the snake gets cut off and now there's just no direct authority that people are used to like following.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle that crisis, you know? And obviously, you know, this is a bit different of a circumstance, but does it make sense to have more authoritarian, you know, politics at that time? And like, how does the evolving situation change with that? You know, obviously if it's a one for all and, or if it's a every man for himself type situation, that does change the landscape and you do kind of devolve back to the only politics that matter, which is the direct and interpersonal politics, you know?
Right.
Which is why, you know, for all of you people out there who think about prepping or anything like that, or you're worried about an emergency, or you just really like thinking that people are useless and you don't need anyone in your life, having people you can trust is the most important thing in a crisis.
Yeah.
It just is.
Self-sufficiency, true self-sufficiency is kind of a fantasy.
Yes.
Yeah, you can't, like... Yes, you can today build yourself an estate in which you like grow enough food to feed yourself and your family. And, you know, well, that really is the most important thing. I guess, you know, you can also learn like some rudimentary medical stuff to keep you, you know, not sick or whatever. But like all of this is propped up. All of this is enabled by the fact that you're surrounded by people who aren't brave enough to come try to take your stuff.
Yeah. We have a name for people like this. Loot boxes.
The person who has prepared and become self-sufficient like that is the loot box. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So when the situation gets dire, you become a big target to everyone around you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't trust anybody, they're just going to overpower you. Right.
Yeah.
And it really doesn't matter how many guns you have either. There's just more of them than you.
Yeah. And you would, yeah, that's just how it is, yeah. You know? And there's no sense in trying to bargain with these people really at that point.
Right. They're desperate.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just going to take what they can.
Yeah. Meanwhile, having people that you can rely on, that you do trust, you know, that is a scarce resource in a crisis. And fortunately, I think that there's a lot of capacity for that that's just kind of built into humanity. I mean, one of the most basic ones is the family. You know, I know it's not in vogue these days to be all about your family. Like, it's kind of in vogue to crap on your family and family structures. And, you know, I'm one who does so myself. But there's a reason that it's always something that gets asked about. And there's, I think, a reason that for a long time there was that whole, who are you? Well, I am so-and-so's son of so-and-so. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why surnames are a thing, you know. It's because we, you know, we human beings for the longest time practically lived in a state of constant crisis. And any connection will do. You may hate your sibling, like absolutely hate them. But in a crisis, you know your sibling,
mm-hmm.
You know them. And that's more
still
valuable.
Safer than a stranger. Yeah.
Safer than a stranger. Exactly. So you're going to rely on them and in some way, shape or form. Now I know that, you know, not for everybody. I know there are some people out there that's like, no, my sibling actually is the worst. They are a crisis. And it's like, okay, that's fair. But like, in general, though.
Yeah, but, like, would you kill them in a crisis? Like,
yeah.
Or do you think they'd try to kill you?
Yeah. Like, if you had two hamburgers, you know, but there was going to be this analogy that you're just trying to survive one more day. Don't worry about the future after that. If you have two hamburgers, you know, would you give them a hamburger? Or would they try to kill you for both hamburgers, you know?
Like, right. Yeah. Are you going to give them one or are you going to fight them?
Right.
Those are your options. Yeah.
Yeah. And most people will take the familiar enemy over the unfamiliar person any day.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in a situation where that isn't already kind of figured out for you, that makes it particularly stressful in a crisis because people are going to be a lot less willing to be kind to strangers as well. For the same reason, you are going to be a lot less likely to be kind to strangers either. And I don't know, like, it just makes sense. Like, yeah, does it suck having to go to, you know, family reunions like every decade or so? Probably, but you know, small price to pay for some insurance. And I do like seeing that, like, there are communities that do come together. Like, if you look at crises like storms, right? Like, when you see, like, a big hurricane come through or whatever, there's always stories of looters, but there's also always stories of people trying to help each other out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just kind of goes to show and illustrate the point. Those who are looting are usually not looting their neighbors. They're looting, like, big box stores and stuff. They're looting the hoarders of wealth. You know, so don't be the big box store in the hurricane, you know, if you catch my drift. And you'll want to be around people that can help. Maybe not the best analogy, because I think with storms and stuff, there's an acknowledgement that, like, this is going to be a temporary circumstance. But in other crises, that's not so much guaranteed. Like, I distinctly remember during, you know, the COVID pandemic or the COVID-19 epidemic or whatever you want to call it. It's a pandemic at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the time it was being referred to as an epidemic in certain places, I think, but.
Well, pandemics are epidemics.
True.
Subcategory.
I thought epidemics were the subcategory of pandemics.
Epidemics are the broader category, but pandemics affect more people at once.
Ah, fair enough. Fair enough. Cool. Yeah. Saying the same thing. Perspective. But I remember distinctly going to my local neighborhood grocery store where normally people were just milling about their business buying food, but the tension in the air was palpable. Like, it was frightening to me how just on edge people can be over something like that. And I'm not saying it wasn't an actual problem, but I am saying that no one in there was dying right then, you mm-hmm. know? But we were all scared and people were, you know, I feel like if someone just charged out the front door, it'd be so easy to cause like a riot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it is genuinely terrifying to think just how dangerous human beings are, that we kind of forget that a lot, you know.
Well, we've kind of learned to get along with one another most of the time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I liken it to dogs, right? If you see a dog in the wild these days, or if you live in a city and you go to the park and you see a dog in the park, most people are not going to go running away from the dog. And if the dog starts running up to you, you're probably not going to run and you're not going to prepare to fight the dog.
Right.
You're going to be like, oh, look, a pupper, a heckin' good boy. Let's see what they want.
Right. Your owner must be around here somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. However, if you've ever encountered wild dogs, you should be terrified.
Yes.
Humans are the same way. We're used to seeing other humans in docile form, you know, but it's terrifying when humans actually are out for for blood and survival.
Or toilet paper.
Or toilet paper. No, okay, no joke, actually. That's a perfect analogy. People bludgeoning each other over toilet paper is hilarious. Any society is three missed wipes away from total anarchy.
I can go without food, but I better not be stinky.
Exactly. You know, and I think all this to be said that I think most people also forget that, you know, politics are just things that we do to prevent violence when we would have otherwise just used violence to solve the problem. And some, I think, philosophers even would argue that violence is politics and politics is violence. Mm-hmm. You know, it depends on whether or not you're prepared to make the leap of the threat of violence is violence or not. Some people, like, what is your opinion on that? Do you think a threat of violence is violence?
It's in a gray area. Like, it depends. It's in a gray area because it depends on how credible the threat seems to the one receiving the threat.
Well, what is it? Okay, what are the components of credibility of a threat? I mean, obviously the capability is one, right? Like if a 4-year-old threatens to stab me to death, I'm a little less afraid than if an adult said it, mainly because they are not capable.
Right.
Well, I say that. They actually are, but...
Okay, if I tell you, give me your wallet, or I will release an army of the dead against your house, right?
Yeah.
You don't believe me.
Yeah.
Right. So you're not threatened by that. But if I already have a knife in hand and I'm holding it up to your gut and say, give me your wallet or I'll stab you, that's a little bit more believable.
Yep.
I would say that that's violence, even if I don't stab you. Or even if I don't have it within me to stab you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But you don't know that.
Sure. So I think the capability is a big component. Like, I would be just as afraid if you were standing 3 feet away from me with a knife. If the knife was out, it's like, okay, that is 100%.
This guy means business. Yep. Yeah.
Let me go down my threat analysis checklist. Are they capable of delivering the threat? Looks at knife? Check.
Yes.
sincerity is a part of it too.
Mm-hmm.
Although that's a weird one because you can sincerely threaten something minor and it's not a big deal. And you can also strongly imply something severe and it'd be even more terrifying. Good example. I've watched a couple of mob movies in my day, like movies about gangsters and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see the really polite gangster talk about, man, you know, it'd be a real shame if you fell off a bridge tomorrow. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
They're not directly threatening you. They're kind of beating around the bush or whatever, but
that's a threat.
It's a threat. And the fact that they're doing it in a polite way is more menacing.
Yes.
It's like, he's threatening me menacingly.
Well, you're also in the polite language. You're like implying that you're going to get away with it too.
That's true.
That's the thing. It's like, it'd be a shame if this happened to you. Not if I did it to you, but it'd be a shame if that just happened to you.
Yeah. And I'm implying that it is more likely than you're thinking right now.
Depending on what your next decision is.
Yeah. And I'm playing with your expectations of bad things happening to you. And I'm slowly increasing those odds and then growing the fear in your mind.
Right.
While also implying that I'm going to be the one who does it to you or have someone do it to you.
Right.
Yeah. So but that's politics too, right? You know, I mean, most people wouldn't think that, but like when a law is passed, any law passed has a punishment attached to it in the code. Like if you go look through any law code of law, it is a requirement that there is a threat behind it.
Right. Or else why would anyone follow the law?
Exactly. And most people don't even think about the threat most of the time. Depends on how docile and compliant your society is. I actually heard there was a really interesting study that I heard about this week that I really want to look into more now that I'm thinking about more about it. That was measuring how agreeable, that's not the right word, how compliant a society would be with a law. And they were looking at different factors. So one of them had to do with like cultures. That's what it was. A culture of compliance. An example being that like within Christians, Catholics are way more likely to be compliant than Protestants. For example.
That makes sense.
Makes sense. And if you look at some of the values of those two different institutions, it kind of is very obvious as to why.
Mm-hmm.
It's obvious that Germany is one of the most compliant countries in the world, where they may not even have to put punishments attached to laws. There is just something about the German culture of following laws as is a cultural appropriateness. You know, like, you know, the Romans would have definitely fallen into this. They had a very
extremely legalistic, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where the law is the law is the law, period, citizen. obviously, the United States is a lot less okay.
But also, painful death was on the table in Rome, so there's that.
True. But I think that kind of goes along with it, is like, how strict are the punishments for laws that might comply with it as well, mm-hmm. you know? I think, you know, as much as we clown and meme on, you know, Kermit the Peterson, or Peterson the Frog, Jordan the Frog. One of the things he did say that I remember watching and going, that's 100% right, and it's weird how many people don't think about that. You know, when he was complaining about, I think it was Bill C-16, was that the one, the Canadian law about coercive speech?
Yes.
So his complaint was that he was going to be forced to say words. This is where his infamous, I'm not going to say your words meme come from.
Yes.
His complaint was that, and granted, he's one for the dramatic. He made the claim that, like, people, you know, they are going to kill me if I don't say these words. And a lot of people looked at him ludicrously about that and said, what do you heckin' mean, you know?
Right, that's not going to happen, yeah.
Yeah, but he followed it down the logical trail of, and this is the part that I looked at and go, I mean, he's not wrong, though, about this part, is it's just a fine. Okay,
I don't pay the fine? And yeah, you follow that to its logical conclusion. Okay, now we're at a standoff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, every law is a threat of violence undertone to it.
Right.
Because ultimately, at the end of the day, the only way, it's, you know, the only way you can guarantee that you're going to get what you want is to take what you want by force. You can work it out other ways, right, that we would like to avoid with force. But at the end of the day,
yeah, we have all these steps that remove people from the direct force. But the force is always there.
Right.
Ready.
Yeah. It is the foundation on which everything exists. And that's not because humans evil. It's just that's nature, you know.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah, we have these steps because, like, most crimes do not fit the punishment of death.
Right.
Right. So, okay, some crimes might be close to that, but we'd rather lock you in a cage instead. Mm-hmm. Right. We just want, because the goal of the thing is to separate you from society whom you're threatening. Or because people don't like being locked up in cages and that will dissuade you from doing it again.
Right.
But some things are even more minor than that, where it's like, okay, well, you're going to have a little less fun this pay period. Give us money mm-hmm. instead. And that'll make you think about doing that again, right?
Right.
But ultimately, it's all backed up by death, actually.
Actually, yeah.
Yeah.
Because what's
if you don't want to pay the fine, well, first they'll issue you more fines, which is hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to pay your $500. Okay, give us $1,000 instead. Yeah, fat chance of that.
I don't think you know how haggling works. Right. You're doing it
You're
wrong.
Doing this the wrong direction. Okay, fine. Well, we're going to come lock you in a cage. Well, I don't want to be locked in a cage. Okay, well, now we're fighting. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think any human can understand this. Good example. Someone does something that you do not like. Could be whatever. It could be harassment. It could be just being annoying to you. It almost always starts the same way. You look over at the person, you tell them to stop. And they look at you and go, no. Okay, seriously, stop. Or what? Or I'm gonna make you give me $5.
How do you intend to do that?
Exactly. At the end of the day, words don't mean anything unless they're backed up by action. And this goes for good or for bad.
Sure.
So that's just how it is, you know? And in the crisis,
I just realized that the inverse of fines, which are words that need to be backed up by violence, the inverse of that is thoughts and prayers.
Yes.
Anyway, go on.
Yeah.
Words of well wishes that don't actually mean anything.
Oh, because they're not backed up by action.
Right, like, because you're not going to do anything. But I'm thinking about you. It's okay.
Yeah. One like equals one child saved. Kony 2012. But in a crisis, I mean, we don't have time for that. You know, like a very, very minor crisis, like an analogy would be your kid, a 5-year-old is about to run into the street and you are within arm's length of them. That is a crisis if there's a car coming.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to A, use your words?
Get back here right now, Timmy.
Or are you going to yank Timmy's arm and pull him up out of the street?
Right, I'm just grabbing. Yeah.
You're just grabbing. And in any other circumstance, like say Timmy is just playing with his toys and you're trying to get his attention. If you just jerk Timmy's arm, most people will look at you and think you're an abusive parent. But in a crisis, we ain't got time for that. You know, and then that's the same. You know, we ain't got time for politics in a crisis. I think where it gets tricky is the middle ground. Like, imagine you're crawling back out of a crisis. Post-crisis, you know, people can start communicating again. And it's often the case that, like, order is not restored immediately. And I'm talking about a true crisis, like a war, right? Mm-hmm. And this is an interesting thing to see happen. When there's a large conflict in an area, like, I'm thinking about like things like the Gambian Civil War, things like that. Like in Africa, there's a civil war between two nation states. There's just vast swaths of land in between where anything goes. It's essentially anarchy. And in lieu of some already established power coming in and just cleaning up, which by the way is how most of those situations end up getting resolved, it takes time for, it usually takes a strong person to stop the things from happening. Like, or a leader of some type. You can be a leader because you can bludgeon people into your leadership, but I think it's a lot rarer because you have to convince, or you have to be charismatic in the way that you can convince people to give you things without having to use even a threat of the force,
mm-hmm.
you know? But either way in those scenarios, it's inherently, you know, unlevel until things return to peace and then people are incentivized to be, to have better things. Cause you know, only when there's enough food for everything to go around can we decide. It's almost like you have to return to a place where survival is just common. And now we're trying to thrive again. So mm-hmm. now I'm willing to cooperate and stop trying to bludgeon people to take their stuff because I've already got enough food to eat. I'm not going to die from that. So how do we do more than this? You know? So I would say politics in that type of that, that's when politics, as we would think about it, the words between the violence probably enters the fray again, like comes back in a major way. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that there can't be instances of it, you know, because I'm sure like in certain crises, you may take that approach early on and people may be willing to like buy into it. And then there's like the internal politics of a, you know, crisis group, like a bunch of survivors on the island might you try to use politics to, you know, come out better, essentially circumvent the, prisoner's dilemma, which is a crisis, really. Because if you think about it, I think the prisoner's dilemma is a perfect analogy for a crisis, just like it is in the representation of politics. You know, we can either advocate against each other in a way in which we both lose, or we both lose because we're going to have to roll the dice. Like, in this case, losing is rolling the dice and seeing which one of you dies, right? One of us is going to die, and that's one of us losing, but we really both lose because how often do you come out of a conflict entirely unscathed, right?
Mm-hmm.
The obvious thing that neither one of them wants is both you both dying in the conflict because, you know, disease exists. But the ideal outcome is that you cooperate, right? It is very hard to negotiate out of that prisoner's dilemma when there's a lot of pressure put on people. And I feel like early on in a crisis, the pressure is not high enough to where you can actually agree to the prisoner's dilemma and come through the event. Like the survivorship example from before. If a bunch of people who are very recently in from a civilized society are in a boat and it crashes and you have a bunch of people on an island stranded, there might be enough food to go around. There's no immediate crises. There's not enough, like there's no immediate death. So there's enough time that you can try to act on the prisoner's dilemma to convince other people that it would be better if we cooperated to get that cooperation. You know, same thing with like having those relationships in a crisis. If you have formed relationships before, it kind of defaults you to that state in the prisoner's dilemma that is a crisis. But very quickly, you'll dip below a period where it's no longer in you know, it's too high of a risk to attempt cooperating and get screwed by the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's not until the risks abate again that you're able to kind of do it. So I feel like anytime in that dip, politics doesn't exist in the broader scheme. It may exist internally in pockets, but the broader sense of cooperation doesn't really exist. And I mean, yeah, at that point, all bets are off. You know, politics are reverting back to the, you know, violence that exists before. But I would be interested in looking into like some examples of like people who have like gone through crises and seen how it went, you know, just to see, you know, and see if you could actually model that on a curve somehow, like take, mm-hmm. take a bunch of crises that happened and measure on a timeline, like how quickly, like look at the outcome. Like did the people bond together and like come through it? You know, the historical, you know, the triumph that we would hope that
yeah.
we in our hearts hope that all human beings would have within them, you know,
mm-hmm.
and see like, when did the cooperation begin and plot on a timeline versus like the ones that did not go that well, you know, and maybe somehow score like how high the pressure would be on a curve. Man, that sounds like some good sociological non-real science studies on how you make that yes. happen, though. I think I've beaten that dead horse enough.
Perhaps.
You have any other last final thoughts about like politics in a crisis?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think as was already said, this is just like a macrocosm, if you will, of everything goes out the window when you're faced with death.
Right? Yeah.
Crisis is the big society stand-in for death.
Mm-hmm.
Something is immediately threatening our big our way of life.
Capital O our.
Yeah. And so, yeah. I mean, so, and as I said at the beginning, I think it does make sense to, you know, alter your principles with changing circumstances. Or, I mean, that's not to say that you couldn't, like, think about hypothetical crisis scenarios and think, okay, now what should we do? And I think that probably is the smart thing to do, is to plan ahead with a cool head about, okay, if a situation like this happens, here's what we should do so that we're not just panicking and doing something. Because anytime that society does something, it's bad.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think that's it. I think the lesson here is be prepared for crises. They will happen.
Yeah.
Think ahead about what you should do in different crisis scenarios and be ready. Don't panic.
Yep. You know, I feel like we need to go back and, because I think I just looked at the name that you put down for this topic. I think we need to have a part two to this at some point that talks more about how, because we alluded to it in the beginning, and I feel like it may have been a little bit misleading that like governments cause all the crises.
Yes.
But we ended up talking more about like the practicals of like politics during a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it would be actually, we'd have to do a little bit of research for it, you know, which heaven forbid we do that. But it might be interesting to go back and look at all the ways that like crises that didn't have to happen that were caused by the exact government that was then later appointed to solve the crisis.
Yeah.
I think there are too many examples of that not to be able to easily do an episode.
Foreshadowing the United States healthcare crisis.
Philosophers.
Philosophers. If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.